We are diverse, independent, and yours. CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Quick note that the following episode of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive.
Canada Land, funded by you.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're going to talk about why you probably know who this is.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
But not who this is.
Something is going on upstairs right now. If you're willing to take a stand and stop being hypocrites, stand up. Everybody stand up. Come on, move! Move! Get off your asses! Follow me upstairs! Let's go!
Wait for that. Close your eyes and try to picture the American Civil Rights Movement. Should be pretty easy. I think that we are all very familiar with the images. They have been repeated again and again, and for good reason. They are not just the stuff of history, but they have been almost mythologized at this point. They are part of our common visual vocabulary. Now close your eyes and try to picture the Canadian Civil Rights Movement. Anything? I don't know, Viola Desmond, maybe, sitting in the movie theater. She's on the $10 bill. Maybe the Underground Railroad. Of course, that's from a different era entirely. What does it mean that we have such a rich visual vocabulary for the American Civil Rights Movement, but almost nothing, for me anyhow, when I try to picture what this looked like in Canada? Does this lack of images mean that there are no images of the Canadian Civil Rights Movement? Or is it just that we have not memorialized and honored them, mythologized them, repeated them? Have we, in fact, lost them? Perhaps some, but others, as it turns out, were just misplaced. My guest today found that footage, tons of images that most of us have never seen. Sometimes that footage was found in archives simply labeled The Blacks or Les Noirs. Filmmaker Michelle Stevenson and her team scoured dozens of archives, finding material for her new film, True North. And what they recovered brings to most of us, for the first time, an era-defining moment in Canada. And Michelle Stevenson joins me in a moment. Wait for it. Quick note that today's show deals with anti-black racism and includes uncensored clips of racial slurs. If you could just tell me your name and what you do.
My name is Michelle Stevenson, and I am a nonfiction filmmaker. Documentaries, creative nonfiction, and I love it.
By now, it's almost a trope, the civil rights montage in an American movie. The first time I saw it, it was so powerful, and I've seen it so many times, and it's the March on Selma, and MLK, I Have a Dream, and lunch counter sit-ins, and child protesters being sprayed with a fire hose. And at a certain point, it just becomes like just a unit of, like, this is the flashback or the montage of the civil rights movement. I've just got such a visual vocabulary in my brain, I think a lot of people do, about what that looked like in the States. I had nothing, no visual reference for what that meant in Canada before seeing your film.
Well, that's one of the reasons why this film is important, and I felt a deep commitment to telling this story. Because I grew up myself in the Eastern Townships, not having one iota of an understanding of black history in this country, let alone the civil rights movement here.
You grew up in the Eastern Townships?
I did. Between Magog, Sherbrooke, Rock Forest, Beauville.
It's very beautiful. I love it there a lot. And I got interested in reading about the history of it. And this is like the whitest, Angloist.
That's right.
Like, what must that have been like for a black girl growing up there?
It was horrible. I was ready to leave as soon as I could. I am originally from Haiti, was born in Haiti. My father is Haitian. My mother's from Panama. And our family and extended family and ourselves basically went into exile when Duvalier came to power. And one of my uncles was working for John Deere and found himself in Hatley in the Eastern Townships. And we would visit there in the summers. And my father fell in love with the mountains of the Eastern Townships. They reminded him of Haiti. And I was a city girl. We were in Flushing, Queens when I was in grade school, and it was a multiracial, multi-ethnic, very urban space. I was a latchkey kid, and then I found myself in the middle of whiteness, literally both snow and population, and hated it. The first time I was called the N-word was at the Hatley Elementary School, my first 3 months there, and I got into fights, and I couldn't wait to get out. So the minute I finished secondary school, I was out, and I was in Montreal with my extended family, where it felt much more welcoming.
As welcoming as it was, your film tells a story of times when Montreal was not especially welcoming to Black people. Can you tell the story of what a lot of people call the Sir George Williams affair? I think a lot of people are still not familiar with this protest at the Computer Center at Sir George Williams University, which is now Concordia University. Can you familiarize our listeners with what happened there?
Sure. At the time in 1968, the university administration was accused of supporting a biology professor by the name of Perry Anderson.
I've had many West Indian Blacks registered in my courses over the last 4 years at Sir George Williams University, and I think that they have been, on the whole, satisfactory.
He was accused of racism by six Caribbean students on student visas. They had all attended Sir George Williams with the aspirations of going to medical school. This class that Perry Anderson ran and taught, you couldn't get to medical school without going through his class. And he was systematically discriminating against these students. And they went through a variety of different homegrown tests that they did that pointed to his racism.
A lot of us immigrants wanted to go to medical school. Students would say, don't take Perry Anderson's class if you don't have to, because he does not like West Indians. The thing is that you had no choice. Perry Anderson was the gatekeeper of that particular course to medical school. My friend Terrence does a report. Anderson gives it a grade of 7 out of 10. His friend, who is white, borrowed the same damn report, copied it word for word, did not make any corrections, handed it in, and gets 9 out of 10.
And so these six students got together and submitted a complaint to the administration at Sir George Williams that was essentially ignored. They promised a hearing, but none of the students were ever heard. And the hearings that did take place did not represent, and they never had the opportunity to present their case. And he was never properly brought to judgment, Perry Anderson. At one of those hearings, the students got angry, and they spread the word, and they started to occupy the downstairs of the Sir George Williams lobby and gathered many colleagues and friends from other universities, other people who were part of a larger community of movement builders that were really fighting for the rights of Black folks in Montreal.
Peace and love, brothers, peace and love. We started out with a complaint against a professor, and now we end up not just fighting the whole administration structure. Let us deal with the central issue today, which is getting the administration to come here and let them negotiate with us to set up a new hearing committee.
Could we have order, please, sir?
And they realized that going up to the computer room would give them leverage to be heard, to really find justice in this hearing and properly hold a hearing that would challenge the findings of the administration. And so they went up to the computer room on the ninth floor and occupied that space for 2 weeks.
Something is going on upstairs right now. If you're willing to take a stand and stop being hypocrites, stand up. Everybody stand up. Come on, move. Move. Get off your asses. Follow me upstairs. Let's go.
Computer center. Computer center. Get moving. Everybody. Those who support our just demands, those who are on the side of justice, move. We will. We will. We will.
the university administration sent the police in, and certain violent happenings occurred that I think we still bear the scars today.
About 4 or 5 in the morning, we looked out the window. Police are storming the building. We were stunned. They tricked us.
And they called out all the police reserves, and police cars are starting to cut in on Bishop Street and block the alleyways here. This minute, something's happening here. Just hang on.
At this point, I've looked up what chance of getting anywhere. The smoke is so bad at this point, you can't see. There's no light. There's no air.
We were in a sea. Sea of whites, and they were chanting, "Let the n****s burn."
So hundreds of students had been occupying the computer lab for about 2 weeks, and it was a largely peaceful demonstration, and at the same time the administration is in talks with the students. But then the negotiations break down. The students say they will not leave the building, and the police are called in to break up the protest, and chaos ensues. A fire then breaks out at the computer lab.
Yes.
There has been a controversy for decades as to who started the fire. According to your film, the police started the fire.
I wouldn't say that. I feel like I've left it sort of open-ended. I know that there are people I've spoken to that will take that secret to their grave. I hope I left it slightly open-ended, but I do know that the violence was provoked by the police, instigated, and they committed violent acts for which they've never been held accountable for.
Cops darted, taking us into the basement of the building.
One policeman threw me on the floor, put the heel of his shoes right on my temple here. And he spun around at least 3 times. My head was exploding.
Okay, after the break, we're going to learn about one of the radicals, one of the student organizers, who, as it turns out, was a personal friend of former Prime Minister Diefenbaker? Michelle, we just heard about the massive protest at Sir George Williams University, which ended in violence and chaos, and with the computer room being burned down. Of course, there were people who organized those student protests. I have to admit, you sent me down a rabbit hole. I had a vague awareness of who Rosie Douglas was, but the amount of stuff I did not know, I mean, that's a movie.
It is.
Can you give me the brief biography of Rosie Douglas, who's an incredible character? Brief is hard with this person.
Is Canada a racist country? A native of Dominica says that it is. He's Roosevelt Douglas, otherwise known as Rosie Douglas. Mr. Douglas, why are you so involved with Canada and the problem of the colored people here?
Well, first of all, I am a black man, and if there are black people here, I am going to be involved in fighting with black people. Further, having been born in the Caribbean, an area where the Canadian people are exploiting in the most vicious and blatant form, it is my responsibility while I'm here to expose this type of exploitation.
I actually went to school with his daughter. We're friends. We went to McGill together, and so I have sort of this indirect connection to Rosie Douglas. He comes from a very wealthy family, a land-owning family in Dominica, and comes as a conservative, a friend of Diefenbaker, to study in Canada. But then he is eventually radicalized when he comes to Montreal to search George Williams. He studied there for a while before this affair and becomes a prominent spokesperson for the rights of black and brown people in Canada. So much so that he is surveilled and found a threat. And as a leader of the movement that happened during the occupation of Sir George Williams, he's eventually arrested, convicted, one of 3 people convicted of the occupation. He spends almost 2 years in jail. And once he's let out, becomes a large spokesman across Canada, forging relationships with First Nations groups, movement building, and became too much of a threat to the RCMP, and they decided to deport him. So a few years after that, he's deported to Dominica, and rises in prominence and becomes a prime minister of Dominica.
When he left Canada, he said, I'll return here when I'm prime minister of my own country. And then he did.
Yes, he did.
The part that had my eyes popping out, it was like he was buddies with Diefenbaker. Like Diefenbaker got him into Canada. It's an extraordinary story. There's an aspect of the whole era that you describe. There was a point of connection with radical politics around the world and Rosie Douglas, interactions with Gaddafi. There was a strain of radical Marxism that was infused in the Black Civil Rights Movement in America and now I know in Canada as well.
The other aspect is understanding at that period, everybody thought revolution was going to happen.
Well, I was interested in the answer given by the Prime Minister today. Three nights ago, he spoke of the danger to Canada in revolution, brought about by revolutionary movements in the United States coming over into Canada. And as far as Carmichael is concerned, he said true revolution wouldn't come about until you pick up your gun and are prepared to kill. In both cases, these people said that they wanted to overthrow the government of Canada by force.
Our elders, these leaders who were there, were deeply committed, understood that at times their life would be in danger, but they were united around this greater cause that, you know, involved the independence movements of Africa and the Caribbean at the same time as things were, you know, there were study circles with C.L.R. James in Montreal and Toronto thinking about radical thought and what could free Black communities look like. At the same time was the state apparatus that was ready to jump at whatever cost to destroy these hopeful utopic movements, and that also defied borders, because the RCMP and the FBI were very much in conversation around these movements and ways to quell it, either through violent or infiltrating means. And I think to a certain degree, they succeeded in crushing quite a significant part of what these movements meant. Struggle continues, but in very different ways. But also the sophistication of surveillance has also exponentially grown. And I think it's made it even more difficult for, you know, cross-border solidarity to take off in meaningful ways. But, you know, I like to think like a Maroon, wherever there is oppression or state violence, there's also inevitably the search for freedom and innovative ways to think about community and survival.
After the break, we're going to hear about the crate digging. How did Michelle and her team recover all of this shocking and incredible footage?
Tim's new craveable wraps are made for the times your boss said the what now, or your teacher mentions that thingamabob. Need a pick-me-up? Snack back to reality with Tim's new craveable wraps. Available in Chipotle or Ranch. Plus tax at participating restaurants in Canada for a limited time.
The film is so ambitious. There's so much unexplored territory to tell. Not just the one story, because there isn't just one story. In telling a Canadian story, it's a multiplicity of stories, because the Haitian experience, you've got figures in the film who are fourth, fifth generation Canadians. So there is the Underground Railroad story. That's the story that was most frequently told. It's a story that Canadians like to tell their children. There's a different story when it comes to Haitian exiles. There's a different story when it comes to Africville. There's many different stories when it comes to the Caribbean and the ways in which people, families were split up to come over. So many stories for a community that is a smaller percentage of the population in Canada than the Black population is in the States. To try to encompass that in a film that isn't even really about that. The film is about the civil rights movement in Canada. Again, it's just a very ambitious undertaking. A lot to take on, no?
Yes, definitely. And I think what fascinated us, me along with our producer Leslie Norville, when we were researching, was the beauty and depth of the archive that did exist that we knew nothing about. We were never taught Black history in Canada, understanding that Black folks came with the Europeans in the 1600s to Canada. As an artist who's really intent not only on uncovering what has been invisibilized for our communities, but also uncovering it through personal voices that in some cases have been silenced or whose perspectives have never been given a space, it was important for us to start with the voices of the people who were still alive. All these people you are talking about who converged from different parts of what I call the Black diaspora came together in Montreal. And their similar experiences in Montreal gave him the strength to protest, to seek the high ground, and to create an equitable space for themselves.
You bring up the archives. I didn't know these images existed. I think when the credits rolled, I counted like something like 3 or 4 dozen different sources. And I thought, just like as an undertaking journalistically, like how much stuff did they go through? Where did they find this stuff? Some of it's shocking, like old news reports, which I don't even know what to make of when you have these interviews in Montreal that on the one hand are so incredibly offensive, asking young black women, do you wish you were white?
Est-ce que vous aimeriez ça, être de race blanche?
And because this is a podcast, we can't give you subtitles. We've asked some of our colleagues here at Canada Land to voice the translations.
Est-ce que vous aimeriez ça, être de race blanche?
Would you like that, to be white?
Oui.
In a way, yes.
Si vous aviez encore le choix entre être...
If you had the choice between being who you currently are or being all white, what would you choose?
J'aimerais être blanche.
Oui.
Oui. I would like to be white, yes.
Or asking white kids, like, what do your parents think of black people?
Tes parents, est-ce qu'ils te parlent des noirs des fois?
Mon père est haïtien.
Your parents, do they speak to you about black people?
My father hates black people.
He doesn't like black people?
No.
Toi, tu aimes les Noirs.
Oui.
Ton père, il les aime?
Oui.
And you like black people?
Yep.
Your father, he likes them too?
Yep.
Your mother also?
Yep.
Do you prefer playing with black children than white children?
There's no difference.
Il y a pas de différence.
It's so incredibly honest, and people are just answering these questions. Like, is this great journalism, or is this horrible?
Qu'est-ce qu'ils ont dit?
Ils aiment pas.
Ta mère?
Ma mère est pour les Noirs.
Can you talk a little bit about the undertaking of assembling the documents themselves, the archives?
The first thing was to find out what exists in the CBC and the NFB and other Canadian archives. It was very important to go to the Francophone archives as well. One shocker that happened during this research we found out is that there were, you know, files of material that were just labeled the blacks, les noirs, from that period. And I was like, oh, we need to go through that because you don't know what famous person might be in there that people just didn't know. So the archive itself, in some cases, was a reflection of the mindset. You know, you mentioned these interviews, like, was this good journalism? Was this bad journalism? It's the same thing in terms of how the archives at the time in certain places we went to reflected, you know, some biases that we dug through. That at the time, you know, were unconscious, right? It was the result of these deep, deep, deep research through these archive producers that we worked with who, you know, did not let go and kept searching. Also, very important was to understand the communities that were rich in Montreal, like the Negro Community Center and the archive that existed there that covered the enjoyment and joy that our elders and some of my friends to this day think about the Negro Community Center in a longing way in terms of place for a community that was safe.
There's an almost hallucinatory quality to the film. Times I didn't know if I was watching an art film, like a work of collage.
Eddie Morrison here, and it's so nice to have you there. Say it loud. I'm black and I'm proud. Go ahead, James.
Or a work of journalism.
You could insult a black person by saying your ancestor was an African. You know, you just like those cannibals in the jungle saying mumbo jumbo.
It has this free-flowing, improvisatory feeling to it, and then it kind of can take a shift and get incredibly rooted in laying out procedurally what occurred, fact after fact. I haven't seen anything quite like it. I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about the process of making it and whether you think of this as a work of collage art or a work of nonfiction documentary journalism.
Well, I am really glad you asked that, because for me, form is also political, and I deeply, deeply, as an artist, challenge how we see things. This is not a history lesson. This is a world building. We were intentionally building a world that people could feel immersed in. Labeling is always difficult, but I do see myself first and foremost as an artist, not a journalist, but using reality as the basis of the palette that I work with. How can we pass this message in a non-intellectual way? That is cinema, right? And that's where the fun is. It's like, how do I not make this dry? How do I challenge myself as an artist? So even the archive, I can't just look at the archive as a mere illustration. No, it's about how can this archive be in conversation with the jazz, in this case, score, music, with the elders who speak today. So we play with polyrhythms. We play with forms of call and response in the editing that are, I think, deeply immersive, and I hope hit people in the heart as opposed to the head, because I think that's what stays.
One last question for you. Thinking back to the people you grew up with in the Eastern Townships and Canada, which arguably is somewhat delinquent and years behind America and other countries in actually looking at itself in the mirror in terms of its history with race and with its black community. What do you hope Canadians take from this film?
I'm happy with who I am, but I think also that I feel like I was robbed of my Canadian history, the complexity of my Canadian history growing up, because I would have had a much different sort of relationship to the country, not being so eager to leave either the Eastern Townships or even Canada as a whole, if I knew about the history of Black struggle in Canada since the 1600s. If that had been centered in the history books that I had read and sort of saw myself in that, I would have had a different relationship to this country. So back to the film, True North, I like to think that it is a statement that honors the complexity of the history of this country, but also honors those who contributed to a larger moral compass and guide that we should always aim towards in this country.
Everybody should go see this film. Michelle, thank you for talking with me about it.
Thank you so much.
That's your Canada Land. I hope you enjoyed it. I can be reached about it at jesse@canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicione. Today's episode was fact-checked by Julian Abraham. Our director of audio is Max Collins. I am the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown. Today we're talking about the news. We'll talk about a government bailout for branded podcasts. Why not? We'll talk about media literacy in Lithuania. Finally. Mostly, we'll talk about Ukraine. The war is still happening. Canada has changed the way that we talk about it. Chrystia Freeland is now making what is essentially a business argument for continuing to support Ukraine, an argument based on their cutting-edge war tech.
A new global arms race for drones has Canada's military playing catch-up.
Ground zero of that race is Ukraine, where drones, large and small, are now the deadliest weapon on the battlefield.
Wait for that. Welcome back to the show. Europe editor at New Line.